It's Wednesday, September 1st, 2010, and you're listening to episode 202 of Fear the Boot, a show about tabletop role-playing games and a little bit more. Running time for this episode is 1 hour and 6 minutes. Welcome to Fear the Boot. My name is Dan.
My name is Pat.
This is Wayne.
And this is Johan.
You know how I knew Johan was coming on this episode?
Feel a little bloated?
I start feeling a little bloated, getting some cramps a couple days before. I knew my monthly visitor was on his way.
Yeah.
And then here he is.
And we had a nice meal, too.
You reconcile that to the joke in any way, shape, or form?
Absolutely. No, I'm not going to do it, but I can do it. I could.
Okay, so
I'll get to it later on.
Yeah, I have some idea how you might do so, so we're going to quickly change subject. All right, first off, Fear the Con 4 dates have been set. We are going to be doing the Wing Night on Thursday, March 17th, 2011. The con itself will be on March 18th and 19th. Those locations have been reserved, and they will be in the exact same places. The Wing Night will be at Cyberg's, and then the con itself will be at Memorial Hall in Blanchette Park. That's all the information we have at this point. We just wanted to get the dates out to you guys so you can mark it on your calendar and get yourself time off work, whatever you need to do. We will start giving you more information as we have it. We hope to have the sign-up site and some more details out soon. But in the meantime, at least
start spreading the word, people.
Yeah, and we definitely hope to see all you guys there. Second thing, there are two Gen Con episodes that are out, which are audio recordings that some of us were involved with, but were not specifically Fear the Boot recordings. And I'm going to link these from the show notes, and I hope you guys will check them out because both of them turned out to be really great shows.
Yeah.
The first was a Pulp Gamer Media Network meet and greet. And as we mentioned in the notes at the end of the show, we are part of the Pulp Gamer Media Network. And so all the shows on that network got together for recording.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. Chris and myself had a chance to be a part of this. The conversation was everything from what do you listen to in a podcast? Why do you listen to podcasts? To gaming and technology. I mean, it was a wide spectrum of conversation that was just a lot of fun. I want to give a shout out to everyone that was on there, the Myriad Games people, the D6 Generation, because it was a lot of fun, met a lot of great people as part of it. We had a lot of fans sitting out there, you know, taking part in it. So definitely everyone, when you get a chance, go out there, take a listen to that, because I had a lot of fun doing it. I know Chris had a lot of fun doing it. It's a great group of people.
And then also the Amorphous Blobcast, the podcast associated with Amorphous Games, there was an interview that they did with me on Sunday after the convention was over, and we talked about what went on at the con, Gen Con and media relations, the state of gaming podcasting. We talked about all kinds of stuff, had a great time talking with those guys, had a wonderful conversation. So you definitely want to check both of those out. Last but not least, and then we're going to dig into the show, gentleman by the name of Cape Rust, presume his real name, I don't know, maybe it's just a moniker he goes by, but he has written something that I want to thank him for, which was a very positive, glowing review of us that was posted over on Geek Life. And I linked to this in a blog post a little bit ago, and I'll put it in the show notes as well in case you didn't catch that blog post. But more than just that article, this is a guy that's written some other great articles out there on topics that range from LARPing to he himself being an ex-military guy. He talks about the reception that gaming and gamers get within the military and how they improvise and play games while they are doing things like manning forward operating positions and such, where they can't be lugging around all these heavy rules books and maps and such. Neat stuff. He's a great guy, and there's some stuff we may be doing with him on some military charities here in the future, but this is something else you definitely want to go check out. So we're going to start this show off with a little game, and I actually mentioned this game in the Amorphous interview, so anyone that is a cross-pollinated listener has already heard this, and we are going to play it here on the show. This is something that you can play along with while you're sitting there at home or at work or commuting or whatever it is you're doing. And I'm just curious to see how this is going to play out. So feel free to play along. We're going to start with Pat. Pat, here's the question. I want you to name the top three games that are your favorite titles or games you identify with, whatever. And these can be homebrews. I will allow that.
Okay. I would say D&D 2nd and 3rd edition would be my first.
Okay.
Or one of them. I don't know if this is necessarily in
doesn't have to be in order.
Deadlands.
Okay.
The various incarnations of Deadlands. And I'd say for a third one, I'd say the homebrew that I played with my first DM with PW that he made, because it's the longest standing one I've been in. So loosely based on D20 system.
Wayne?
actually two of mine are two that I've never played before, but I still want to throw them out there because I just am excited about them. Quags.
Okay.
The Fate system, particularly the Dresden File versions of it, but the Fate system in general really excites me. And Skies of Glass. I have a lot of passion for Skies of Glass, and that may be partially because it was my first, you know, RPG ever. It may have been because of the game. It may be because I'm writing fiction based in that world. I don't know what it is, but I am really passionate about that system, and it's the only one of the three I've actually played.
Okay, Johan?
Dungeons & Dragons, Shadowrun, and for the third, I have no idea what I would go with. I say Lost Souls.
Okay, so D&D, Shadowrun, Lost Souls. My top three, once again, in no particular order, but I'm going to go with Battletech, the fastest Star Trek, and then Epoch Arisos, homebrew.
I may have to rethink some of mine, too, because you guys both mentioned some. I even like the Hero System. I actually played Hero System and enjoyed it a lot.
Well,
when
right.
I played in it, too. So.
Just for
whatever.
I
picked.
This doesn't have to be precise. I'm just trying to ballpark this. Now, here's the follow-up question. Of the games in your top three list, how many have you played a campaign of within the past year or two?
Zero.
Yeah, none.
Well, easy answer.
Well, we're playing D&D right now.
Oh, okay. For me, one.
Easy answer for me. The one Skies of Glass game was in the past 2 years, so one. I've never even played the other two. I just am excited about them.
For me, the answer is the same. We had an Epoch Arisos game that didn't last very long just because there were a bunch of failures we made on our part the way we always do. We don't take our own advice, but it didn't work out for very long. I have not played Star Trek or Battletech in years. Battletech longer than Star Trek. It may be nigh on a decade since I've played a Battletech campaign. So here's the interesting thing. As I sit around and talk to a lot of geeks, I find that this is the case. The games that people will list as those that they like the most, or perhaps they would also say they identify with, a lot of times are titles they are not actually playing. If you look at where someone says their heart is, it's in one place. But if you look at where their money and time is, it's actually oftentimes someplace very different. Why do you guys think that is? I have several theories.
Well, I think an easy one would be just look at the answers that went around this table. Of the four of us, only Johan and I had a common answer right. In D&D. Of the rest of us, we didn't have one. So right there is a good example of probably why a lot of people aren't. They just can't get a group together that wants to play in their favorite system. Well, I certainly know with this gaming group that we've got now, we play with what we can finally agree on. And it's like the lesser of the evils that we can agree on.
Run a Shadowrun campaign, but it is never going to happen.
Oh, Chad loves it.
Oh.
He loves Shadowrun. He's just putting up an image.
Well, and my thing is I'm up for trying new games. I always want to try new things. Even though I have systems I'm passionate about, I want to try something new. I would play a Shadowrun game. I don't care what someone wants to play. I'll play anything that I haven't played before at least once.
I just haven't been gaming lately. That's my only
excuse. That's a big one, too.
That I haven't played my favorite games in the past 2 years. It's that I haven't gamed in the past 2 years.
You haven't played games in the past two years. So, yeah. As I was thinking this through, I came up with a couple reasons why I think this occurs. And, Pat, the first two are both pretty similar to what you said. One is group consensus. If you have a group of people, you can only play one game at a time. And if you are in a group that likes to keep long-running campaigns, or at least even midterm running campaigns, let's say campaigns that we are going to measure at least in months, not days or weeks, then you can only play one game at a time, and so something has to lose. You simply cannot play all the cool games that are out there. You have to pick something to narrow down on. The second and related idea is you may also end up with the veto votes, that no matter how much you love a particular game, there's one or more people in your group that have tried it and hate it, or maybe are so against the idea, they just won't even try it. You can't even get them to give it a fair shake. But I also wonder if some of this is in many ways similar to something that I heard expounded upon by a social psychologist several years ago. I used to work for General Motors, specifically within what they call their IPL, or their insurance personal lines. And they hired a guy by the name of Dr. Rapai. He did a series of cultural studies specifically on Americans, and he himself, I believe, is French, on the way that we think and the way that we function and what makes us culturally unique from the rest of the world. And he came up with some really interesting stuff. But who he actually did this for in the anecdote I'm going to give was for Chrysler, not for General Motors, where they hired him to basically find out, why do people buy cars? And part of what motivated this was, if you sit down with a focus group and ask people, what do you look for in a car? Well, what people would typically say is, well, I look for good fuel economy. I look for safety standards. I look for affordable prices. Yet they're rolling around in these giant SUVs that fit absolutely none of the criteria that they've just listed. So they hired him to basically find out, why do people really buy the cars that they buy? And he discovered all these things about the close association that Americans have between self-image and their automobile, which is not entirely unique, but is somewhat different than how the rest of the world views their automobiles. To us, they're not just possessions. They're an extension of identity in some way. I realize this is massive overgeneralization, and his study was far more nuanced than this, but bear with me because I'm just trying to abstract at a high level here. But I wonder if in the same way, gamers sometimes identify with games because they scratch a particular itch, because they make them feel good about a particular bit of the hobby, but it's not in truth how they actually operate.
Okay, Dan, I want to take this one step further. Con games. How many con games have you run in the last 2 years that are of the systems you named? The number is getting considerably higher as you do the
math.
Yes,
actually
it is.
It is. Almost all of them. Almost all of them.
Both of the con games I've run have been on my list. They were Skies of Glass. Why is it that gamers for con games tend to go to the games that they actually do establish as their top games?
You know what?
Why are they their comfort games? They're safety blankets.
Because you don't have to appease anyone.
Exactly.
When I go into Fear the Con, you know what game I'm running? Whatever game I damn well want to run.
Yeah.
I don't have to get consensus from five pre-selected people. I instead put up a game and five people select themselves. If I'm going to play a game, same thing. I'm selecting myself. They put a game out there. I have said, oh my gosh, I love this game. I get to play what I want to play.
And there's no commitment.
But at Fear the Con 1, 2, and 3, I ran Epoch Horizons, Star Trek, and the only game that I ran that I can recall off the top of my head that was not on the list I just gave was Transformers.
I think that point really drives it home. I think what it really gets to is the two points that we're talking about in the first place, Dan, is the fact that you just have to have that group consensus. If you don't have everybody around the table agreeing to it, then you're just not going to be playing these systems that are your favorite.
Yeah, for a one-shot, you don't have to have that commitment. You just have to have people being committed to a four-hour time chunk. I mean, do you have a lot less that you have to bring to the table? And I think that's why people are more comfortable. They want to go to their strength. They don't want to put that effort out for something that may not be what they're as happy with.
Let me ask another question, somewhat related to where I was going with this whole Dr. Rapai thing. Have you guys ever bought a book from a company, specifically a gaming book, because you really like something about the game, you really liked something about the company, you really liked something about the authors, I don't know what the case is, but somehow you identified with it and ended up on a shelf, and the reason it's on a shelf is not because your gaming group rejected it, it's because you bought it, took it home, put it on a shelf, and never picked it up again.
Yes.
Yeah, I've done that with, I have a shelf of those, actually. I've got tons of RPGs at home that have never been played. I bought them because I was interested in them, they looked like they would be fun, and then they went on a shelf.
You know, I never really have done that myself. And I think the reason for it is that, again, my friend PW, he owns like every single RPG that ever comes out. It comes out, he gets it. He gets it early. He has them all, and he has them all on a shelf. We would never play them, or we might try to play them a little bit and then wouldn't continue with it or whatever. But at least 75% of the books that he's got are games that he's probably never played. I saw that, and probably just the close association with it probably kept me from doing it. So I learned early on, okay, I'm not going to waste my money and effort on a game until I play it a little bit and see if we like it and we're going to stick with it. And then I'll go with it. I'll sort of stick with it from there.
I've never played any game that I own. I've never actually played a Savage Worlds game. I own Savage Worlds. I bought Cap for my wife. I've never played it. I have Mutants and Masterminds. I've never played it. I've got three or four down the list.
I know you're going to play Savage Worlds eventually. I think, Wayne, part of the problem you had there was you came in at an unfortunate time in the group, not for the group overall, but just for Savage Worlds, because when you came in, we had played about 2 or 3 years straight of Savaged everything.
Yep.
And we were so freaking burnt out on the system that we ran away from it for a while. But it's a great system.
It is.
I know we'll come back to it. It's just you came in right when we were at our final breaking point.
Yeah.
Of whatever it is we play next, we don't care. Just not Savaged Worlds, mm-hmm. something or other.
You know, and I bought Savaged Worlds on Free RPG Day because it was half off. I mean, $9.99 is a tempting RPG, but $4.99, I'm not going to pass that up.
Right. Yeah, and I know certainly with some games, there is the thing where you have a game you just can't play because you can't play every game all at once in your group, or there's somebody that's vetoing ideas that you like. An example I would give is several people have recommended to me the game Firestorm Armada, which is basically a capital ship broadsiding sort of game. And I've been picking up a little bit of the game, and I kind of like it. But I know if I bring this over on a Sunday, someone like Chad, he might give it a go for Sunday. He's not going to let me write an RPG into this thing and build a campaign around it. He's just not going to have it. But having said that, I really do wonder if, just like with our automobile buying habits, that the self-image people have for themselves of kind of who we think we are as geeks and how we think we operate, oftentimes for reasons that are purely internal, that are purely egocentric, that have nothing to do with anyone but ourselves, in fact, do not correspond with how we behave.
Another aspect of it could be simply, I think it's human nature to want to experience new things, try the new games that are coming out. And even though you love these games and you would probably be happy playing your favorite game into eternity, I think there's just this pull or desire to hopefully, hey, there's the next better game out there.
The new shiny.
The new shiny. And let's see if this is it. And let's see if this one can be as good or even better than my favorite.
Right.
So I think that's the ever striving goal.
The never-ending quest for the holy grail of gaming.
Yeah.
The game that's going to be the perfect one that doesn't have those little flaws that your previous favorite game has. And, you know, even though you really know that there is no perfect game out there, you're going to keep getting them.
And I think that very fact is what fuels a lot of the homebrews that get made, too. Mm-hmm. You've got all these little quirks and things. And, man, I know this could be done better. I could do this better. And then there you go.
I think someday we are going to have to give Hero System a try.
I like it.
You know why? I've actually figured out it is the most friendly of all the role-playing games out there. It's the only one that would take a bullet for me.
That's true. I know it's an intimidating game to get into, but my fond memories of it are actually the game that I played. It was a modern spy, you know, X-Files type of a drama game. It was set in my hometown, which made it really cool. And the system, after I got used to the whole, whatever, the phases, and you count down the bubbles, and now it's your turn to act, and then, oh, the next bubble, it's weird, but you sort of get it down. It was kind of cool.
I don't know. I may give it a second chance. The one time I played it, and this was years ago, it was just a mess, but I also know, I think I'm like on a sixth edition now or something like that.
Most likely.
I know it's way down the chain, so I have no idea what this current state of the game is, but
I would definitely try Champions, which is a spinoff of the Hero System.
Yeah. You know what? I'm sorry. I think I've been talking about Champions.
Yeah, it was actually
Champions. My bad, my mistake. Yeah, Heroes, that's where you literally have to have spreadsheets. You have to have Excel to calculate all the crap that's going on. That's the one that I didn't play. A friend of mine at work was trying to foist it on me, and I looked at it and learned a little bit about, there were just hundreds of pages of graphs to cross-reference to see, you know, how much a splinter does damage. And I'm like, yeah, this is way beyond me. I am mathematically inclined. I love numbers and I love all this crap, but this is way overboard. So
we've got another topic that was sent in by Joshiva. He has yet to send me an email correcting the pronunciation of his name, so he's going to continue being Joshiva for now.
He has posted that he's amused that that's the pronunciation we went with.
Well, like I said, if he'd sent me a pronunciation guide or he could have corrected me at any point, I would happily pick something else. But as long as he leaves me in this vacuum of ignorance, I shall continue pronouncing his name Joshiva. And sir, with the last name that I have heard every possible pronunciation. At least with yours, I'm not inventing letters. You would not believe how many people stick an N.
What do you mean, Mr. Reppinger?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. You
know, the thing that always amazes me is I always get people asking me how to spell my last name.
Roper?
Yeah. How hard is it to spell Roper? And I tell them, I said, you know what? It's rope with an R. The typical thing, you're always going to restaurants or whatever, and you put your name in and say Roper, and they're like, how do you spell that? And like, you got to be kidding me. They want to put two P's in there. I'm amazed. I just don't get it. It can't get much simpler than that.
The next topic of his that we are taking on is he asked us to talk about riddles. Now, I am going to change his topic a little bit because more than just riddles, I want to talk about puzzles within role-playing games. And I believe this is generally what he's getting at, because he does talk about this in a somewhat broader sense, even as he was writing about riddles. But I want to talk about stuff where you have any non-obvious answer, and brute force or pure social engagement was not the intended solution. Now, this could be puzzles in the very traditional sense of pulling levers and moving blocks to get a door to open. This could be, as he suggested, something like a riddle, where you have to answer an obscure question or piece together bits of conflicting information to create a consistent picture to move on. This could, quite frankly, even be a combat thing where, through observation and experimentation, you have to figure out that an otherwise invincible monster can't handle the color green and somehow use that to defeat him. But it's just something where there's some kind of a non-obvious thought-based answer in order to move forward. Part of what also figured into this was our recent Gen Con experience at True Dungeon. With True Dungeon, you walk through sort of like a live-action dungeon that has animatronic monsters, it has props and special effects. It's a really cool sort of thing. And a lot of the rooms, you have to solve puzzles, oftentimes through teamwork and all kinds of stuff, in order to move forward. And that also got me really thinking about this subject and how to approach it on the show, and also kind of help me take opinions that I've been passively forming over 20 plus years of gaming and really started giving sort of form and organization to them. Because as I went back later to fill out the survey form on True Dungeon, I suddenly had to elocute. I suddenly had to take all these ideas and structure them into words, which is something I never had to do before. Because I'd known how I felt about puzzles, but never really had to explain it. All right, so with all that said, start at the first step, which is designing them. And there was a thought that I had on the subject. If your only purpose for a puzzle is to give the party something to do in a room, to slow them down, to make something harder, in my mind, this is...
And if you're doing that by not giving your players a key piece of information they need to solve the puzzle, you're just being a dick.
Expect to get punched in the face.
Yeah, I have seen that. I was playing a game once and I was in a room and there was a puzzle and the information we needed to solve the puzzle was actually pretty easy. The GM intentionally was withholding it because he had a scheduled time. He was trying to make this game last an entire slot. And sure enough, after a certain amount of time ticked off, we spent his allocated amount of time on the puzzle. Oh, by the way, you see this in the room. Seriously, this is what you're going with. Seriously.
Johan, when we were setting this up, one of the things that came out in our conversation as a great metaphor, source of inspiration, or maybe source of warning, I don't know which, is the old Infocom games. And for anyone whose video gaming does not go back that far, there was a company called Infocom, which was bought out by Westwood, which in turn was bought out by Electronic Arts. And what Infocom was known for way back in the day was the text-based adventure games. It was stuff, they did not make King's Quest specifically, I don't think, but it was stuff along those lines. They did things like Wishbringer, Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, Planetfall, Walk North, Get Torch, Walk South, Light Oil, Throw Oil. And a lot of the game hinged on trying to figure out how to take the environment and the items that you had and do creative things with them in order to get a door to open or find a safe way past the grue. And Johan, first off, you said that if someone brought one of these puzzles to the table, you would punch them.
Absolutely. I'm sorry. This has been 20 years since I've played an Infocom game. I still have nightmares about the screening door from The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. I spent so many hours trying to beat that. Eventually, I believe I looked it up 10 years later in a walkthrough guide that a friend of mine had. And it's absolutely impossible to come up with that solution through any means other than reading the book. The games are full of those. It's a random combination of items that you do random things with, and suddenly a solution appears. Another example from those games was I played the text-based Lord of the Rings, and walking through the Mines of Moria is literally 2 hours of picking random directions until eventually you come out the other side. There is no difference to any of the rooms. There is no rhyme or reason to the patterns. You just go until you come out and hope that you make it out before you run out of food, because if you run out of food, you die. And then you start over from the Shire. Oh, wow. Yes. If I have a DM who brings me something like that and I'm playing in his game, I reserve the right to punch him in the face.
Yeah, let me give you a hint for anyone that's doing a game. If your party has to solve the puzzle by trial and error, it's a poorly designed puzzle. If they are choosing to solve the puzzle through trial and error, your party is probably just not that interested in puzzles to begin with. This is probably not the best way to play your game. But Johan, the thought I was pursuing here was you then went on to tell us about a module called the Tomb of Horrors.
Oh, absolutely. The Tomb of Horrors is wonderful. I'm sure anyone...
Yeah, and this is what I want to hear explained. Is the cognitive dissonance, well, punch you over Infogom games, but the Tomb of Horrors is wonderful. So explain Tomb of Horrors, and then I want you to
because
explain...
I would punch a GM if they brought a Tomb of Horrors in front of me.
I would shoot a GM in the face if they brought this to a table. So Johan, explain Tomb of Horrors, and I want you to hear the explanation behind why one's acceptable and one isn't.
Of course. Well, Tomb of Horrors is one of the original first edition Dungeons & Dragons modules,
right.
And it is a holy relic among first edition D&D gamers. Anyone who's been playing D&D for long enough to remember it, you bring it up and their eyes will light up in either joy or hatred. There is no middle ground. It is essentially a lengthy series of death traps. The party is a very high level by first edition standards party. I think it's made for 16th to 18th level characters. So they are far beyond any sort of normal challenge that would be thrown their way in a first edition D&D game. And they go off to fight this legendary lich who's been hiding out in these catacombs for eons, and you're going to go kill him. And you delve down into the dungeon. Every 10 feet, there's a save or die if you don't do the right thing. And that's a little bit of an exaggeration, not much. There's teleport traps everywhere. There's anything that you can think of that would ruin a party of high-level D&D characters is in this dungeon. And spoiler alert, the catch here is that there is no real solution to the dungeon. The Lich is in a room that you can't really get to unless you've read the adventure in advance. He's behind 20 feet of solid rock in any direction. You just can't do it. The only goal is to go in and come back out alive. It's a badge of honor for a character to have survived that.
Yeah, his dungeon is basically rope-a-dope, or it's like a monkey trap.
Absolutely.
For anyone not familiar with the monkey trap, the idea is you take a gourd, you cut a hole in the gourd, put a piece of fruit in it, but the hole and the fruit are the exact same size, so a monkey reaches in, trying to grab the piece of fruit, and then dies in this trap because it won't let go of the fruit. Where the dungeon is only there to kill people as they go through it.
Exactly. That
it's
is
not
the
actually
only purpose
meant to
of
be
the
winnable.
Dungeon. Right.
Why? I got to give it to the wizard, though. Because personally, if I were a lich or wizard or something, and I had the ability to teleport inside a box of concrete, I would probably do the dungeon. I would put out clues for people to come get me. And I'd just sit back,
well,
you know, and have a drink.
Have your video cameras strategically placed.
Yeah.
This is his entertainment.
Because it's one of those things when you...
CCTV, baby.
When you hear these stories, you wonder... Why do they put all of these traps like this? I am testing you to make sure you're worthy to fight me. Personally, if I put all those traps in front of you and you make it to me, I don't want to fight you. I want to get out of there. So I like the idea of having the kite. Well, I mean, so I would punch a GM in the face if they did it to me. But. Wait,
that is absolutely one of the big points I want to talk about here is the internal consistency of a puzzle's very existence. But I first have to hear the answer to this because we didn't get it off the air. Johan, how the hell is that something that you would cheer while punching a GM over an Infocom Gru puzzle?
Well, first, you probably have to understand my personal style of gaming that I prefer. I prefer two types of games.
Okay.
Either a story-heavy, intrigue-based, politicking, things of that nature, or tactical, lethal combat. I like the minis on the table. I like to move them around. I like my huge sheets full of my powers on my character. And I like to make strategic tactical decisions round by round and beat the game. So this is a prime example of the second. This is a tactical assault on the dungeon. This is the ultimate challenge for my character. A lot of people don't enjoy that type of game. That's fine. I do. An Infocom style puzzle interferes with either one of those games. If you throw, all right, spend 20 minutes of game time walking through, picking directions in this cave until you come out the other side, I am neither killing things nor am I talking to people.
Right.
I'm bored. Can we just go on now? If I'm stuck at a door trying to solve a riddle to get past, I don't care. Let me go.
Yeah.
That's my issue. And I should also probably go ahead and say on the mics, because one of my players is bound to be listening to this, I have done this before. I've put obnoxious riddles into one of the games I ran. I probably deserve to be punched in the face a few times. It does not go over well. It has never gone over well anytime I've tried it. And so I have a negative sheen over my opinions on this.
You know, there are two reasons why I don't use a lot of puzzles in my games. Well, maybe three. One of which is, I guess, just the style story I tell rarely would have the opportunity for a puzzle in the classical sense. And I think there are puzzles apart from the classical sense of move three blocks in a certain way to get a door to open. And we'll talk about those. The second thing is I'm better designing plots than I am at puzzles. It's hard for me to come up with this type of thing. And as a result, I think a lot of times I have taken what for me has been the easier way out of just saying, I'm not going to go there in the game.
You know, that's actually what Chad said. I've talked to him about it off the mics. And he says he's really bad at puzzles. So anything he could come up with, you and I sitting down there would just blow it away so quickly, it wouldn't be worth it for him.
Well, the third thing is, the few times I've tried, I have to admit it hasn't gone very well. And this right here, this point, Wayne, that you brought up, which is what we're going to hit on right now, the reason I think they've never played out very well is because of the fact that they have always had no contextual sense of belonging. You walk into a room and there's a puzzle you have to solve for no other reason than they're giving you a puzzle just to get out of the room or to get onto a treasure chest or whatever. And there is no really honest reason for it to exist apart from that.
You know, and all of the examples we have from True Dungeon, I had fun with those puzzles. Those puzzles all fit that category for me. Everything we went in there and did are the kind of things that just wouldn't fit in a dungeon for the most part. I mean, there were a couple of exceptions, but, you know, the first puzzle we have is a giant labyrinth game.
You know what True Dungeon was? It's flag football for nerds.
Yeah.
It's a wonderful experience. If you've never done True Dungeon or able to go out to Gen Con and do it, absolutely, by all means, get out there and do it.
Yeah, it was great. I look forward to doing it again.
But it's flag football for nerds. I mean, the simple fact of the matter is, I do not hold True Dungeon up as a good example of a role-playing game. I hold it up as a great experience, but I would not hold it up as a good example of a role-playing game. There's a quote here that Yoshiva sent in, which I'm going to read. This is a relatively short quote, but I think it summarizes exactly what my frustration with a lot of puzzles are. He says, "Any riddle lacks meaning when its existence cannot be explained. Much like a pressure plate in a well-traveled hallway, unexplainable riddles remind you that the setting isn't real." Can you come up with a good reason why a wizard put a trap in a room where you can't leave until you realize that you have to pull a lever while looking in a reflection?
Crazy wizard.
Mm-hmm. And that's what you end up with, was crazy wizard, maybe test of intellect. One of the things that Yoshiva tossed out was it may have been some kind of a test of worthiness. Getting through this is his way of finding out whether you're worthy of whatever sits beyond. And perhaps that's believable.
Yeah.
Depending on the situation.
I agree with you. And I personally love puzzles. When I encounter some good ones in a game, and I have actually had some very good puzzles in games in the past, I've had a lot of fun with them. And these could have been things where it literally sat down and we had to puzzle through these things and try to figure it out. It may have taken us half an hour to come up with it. We were fine with that. It was fun. It was a good puzzle. It was presented well, and it was contextually, it made sense. So that covered all those areas, and we were invested in it too. We liked it. I think you've hit the nail on the head with, it has to make sense with the setting. And like for me, if I was doing this, I think one of the very best examples of a good puzzle slash trap is Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade. The challenges that he had to go through to get to the Grail, to get to the knight, you know, to the Grail. Those were perfect to me because it was testing the worthiness. My favorite one is, you know, the penitent man shall pass. A penitent man kneels before God. He did that and he didn't get his head caught off and he was able to get through it there.
It's because he passed a saving throw.
It will exactly
save or die.
That kind of a thing. And those were well presented. And if I was running this, that is what I would shoot for.
You know, that was going to be one of my examples as well, because that last challenge you have there, you know, you're in that room with the Grail and there's all these Grails in front of you. That to me, that was a cool final test.
Yeah.
You've got all of these in front of you. You're not meant to actually get this. You've made it all this way. You've made it past everything. You're not supposed to get it. If you do get it, you obviously know enough to be worthy for it.
You know, actually, I would have to go with Pat more than the three tests leading up to it. It was the Grail test that I thought was the best puzzle there. This is the cup of the son of a carpenter
was. What you're really getting at, though, is that test was more of a test of intelligence, or maybe not as much that, it's a test of theology. You know, it's, you're really familiar with the,
well,
with
not
the
just theology, but it's the test of heart as well. Because first of all, it made sense within the setting because of the fact that they were not looking for the Grail to fall into the hands of someone whose heart was not in the right place.
Right.
And so you have some tests leading up to the test that check for that. But then also once you are in there, you then have all these big, expensive, gaudy, jewel encrusted cups, which are going to attract the eyes of a greedy person,
yeah,
as opposed to the humble cup that was the cup of Christ. Mm-hmm. And so it made sense for it to be there. The solution is the sort of thing that someone who's familiar with the subject matter could be reasonably expected to muddle through.
Mm-hmm.
It's not so obscure that you can't possibly solve it. And obviously experimentation is not the way to get through.
Exactly. Yes. You chose poorly. But yeah, so for me, that's what I would shoot for. And that's a tall order. That's obviously well scripted, well put together, well filmed. But I have encountered puzzles that are very good and were very entertaining. And it worked.
That's one of the reasons I've been asking you to talk about this topic for a while, because I would love to have puzzles in my game, and I have no idea how to make them work.
Let's go through some other reasons puzzles might exist. Wayne, one you threw out, and this might come up only in certain kinds of games, but you threw out as an example, what if we're running a superhero game and the villain's the Riddler?
Yeah, I mean, It's a common trope of that era of superheroes. You've got the villain taunting the hero. He's leaving riddles for them. Even if it's not, something like the Riddler, it's common. You've got to be able to have that in your game or you're losing the feel. But if it's too cheesy, you might also lose the feel of your game that way, right, too.
An idea that Yoshiva threw out in his email that I thought was just awesome was you may have a wizard where he has passphrases or key items for his possessions or for his most important rooms. But because of the fact that he's an aging guy and getting senile, he doesn't remember things the way he used to. And so he leaves clues for himself sitting around. They're not meant for you. Johan, you work in computer support. And as you mentioned, a trick that I've used as well, if you ever need to log onto someone's computer and they're not there, the first thing you do is look under the keyboard. The second thing you do is check the top drawer.
Yeah.
And a lot of times you will find their password or some kind of a password hint. Why is it there? Because they themselves have trouble remembering it.
Yeah.
So there's an example of something completely internally consistent on why a puzzle might be there. Another example is an environmental puzzle. When we did the series on dungeon design, we talked about the environmental trap. The bridge is not trapped. It's just old and crappy. And in the same way, you may have a puzzle that nobody put there. It's just the way the situation works. You've got to get five people across a chasm. There's a rope and a basket that only holds one person at a time. And something has to be on the other end to manipulate the rope and whatever. I haven't thought this through all the way, but you get my point. If you could have a situation where the environment itself, for purely natural causes, is the puzzle.
Right.
I mean, think about how many problems you have to solve in a day that are not there because someone's trying to obfuscate your life, but are there because real life presents challenges that don't always have an obvious solution.
You know, the sad thing about that example is, as you were giving it, I kept remembering Chad actually threw us one of that in our game. We debated it. We talked about it for probably 15 minutes and finally said, wouldn't our characters know just how to deal with this? There was no bridge. We need to get across the river. And we're talking about how are we going to do this, trying to puzzle it out. In the end, we realized we don't care how we get across. We just want to get across.
I think the difference there,
we were going to get across no matter what.
Right. And I think that's probably the point there is that he wasn't trying to create a puzzle. He didn't want a puzzle. He wasn't really sure we wanted a puzzle, or if we did, certainly the puzzle wasn't supposed to be an Oregon Trail of how to cross a river with a wagon. And so he just you're across, but let's just hand wave and move on. Another thought, keep the whole group involved. Just like with anything else in a game, if you've got one guy who's really into logic puzzles and three people that aren't, it's okay. You can have the spotlight on one guy. That's not a bad thing. But do your best to get everyone involved in some way. If necessary, make the puzzle require multiple people, offer clues to multiple people, or perhaps give the puzzle multiple aspects. Some examples. In True Dungeon, when you entered a room, we were able to all kind of fan out and examine things separately, come up with our own ideas and talk them out. Within a tabletop role-playing game, you might be able to do that since the GM's a bottleneck. Something else you could do to keep him involved is if one guy's not into puzzles, find out what he is into. Maybe there's a monster that's attacking the party and he's got to deal with that monster while the rest of the party tries to solve the puzzle. There's all kinds of ways you could approach this. Maybe you know that a particular person who's not all that into puzzles, but has a skill set, they know a lot about a particular area, And so you'll make that puzzle appeal to that. So they're going to have to involve this guy. This guy's going to have to jump on in order for them to get through that particular obstacle.
You know, and I've seen this done very well in literature quite a few times. That concept of this character or this person has some key piece of knowledge, and that's your way of giving them the clue to move on, is a pretty common trope that works very well.
Something else that I want to hit on real quick is the difficulty of a puzzle. We've talked about this kind of peripherally, but now I want to hit it more directly. If a puzzle is too easy, you as a game master may find yourself frustrated by the fact you put it in there at all. You spent 2 evenings writing up this puzzle and they had it figured out within 3 minutes. Wayne, that's kind of what Chad said to you, that he's worried that if he put out a puzzle, Pat and I would break it too quickly or whatever.
Yeah.
All on the same lines, if you make it too obscure or too hard, the group may become frustrated because of the fact they can't figure it out. Something that is obvious to you may not be obvious to them. A solution that makes total sense in your mind is simply not how anyone else in the group thinks. And I think one of the great things you can do to try and protect yourself against this is, first of all, know a little bit about the interests and the knowledge of the people within the group. Don't make a puzzle that involves a subject nobody knows anything about.
Here's another risk that I was just talking about as we were talking about it. What if you make it where one person has that knowledge and you know they do, and that guy can't make it to gaming that week?
You don't put the puzzle in.
Exactly. You've just spent 2 days, 3 days, however long, coming up with this thing perfect for the party, and now you're out of a lot of material because that guy's not there.
The other suggestion I'd have is don't hesitate to test run it. Even if you find people who aren't all that into gaming, you could always find people that are into puzzles. Grab somebody you work with and say, hey, let's say you had this in front of you. How do you solve it? See if they pick up on it. You know, make it a what-if sort of game. See if they pick up on it. If you know someone's a role player, all the better. If there's a forum that you frequent or a community that you're involved with, shoot a PM to a couple people on there that aren't in your gaming group. Lay out the puzzle for them. Let them muddle through it. See if they get it or not. See how they think. That's something that we found at Gen Con was when we were going through the puzzles at True Dungeon. A lot of the game masters in the rooms were telling us that people were tending to follow pretty similar patterns in approaching these puzzles. And then there were rooms where the majority of people got it, or pretty much nobody got it. And on those latter rooms, I think that's a really obvious sign to the people that run the game that those puzzles may not have been the best designed.
I would say along those lines, too, if you're going to go to the trouble to put a puzzle in, you're worrying about people being able to come up with a puzzle on their own that might challenge people. Do your research. Go out online. All you have to do anymore, especially these days, is go to Google, type something in, and then sit there and read for a while. And you can research things fairly well. I think that you should do that. There's plenty of puzzles out there. There's all kinds of things. If you can't come up with something great on your own or you need a little help, go out there for some inspiration. I'm not a fan of going out and just copying for, you know, verbatim, because that's kind of dull. But you can certainly get ideas. You can incorporate a little of this and a little of that out there. And that sort of goes along with what you're saying, Dan, too. That way, you know, you can see what's been used, what's worked, reading off forums. You can throw it out there as well. But yeah, definitely. And, you know, like my answer to Chad would be, you know what? If he makes a puzzle that Dan and I or all of us are able to work out in 2 or 3 minutes, who cares? It was a puzzle. I enjoyed it. I got the answer. You know what? I win. I had fun. I solved it.
Another advantage to going out online and going to a third party location to get your puzzles is you can test run it yourself, because you can do the puzzle. You can see if you can come up with the answer. And that helps make sure you're not getting an unsolvable puzzle, because if you can't figure it out, you don't use that
one.
There's some risk it still may be idiosyncratic to your way of thinking.
That's true.
But nonetheless, you didn't design it, and therefore cannot be purely idiosyncratic to your way of thinking.
At least two people can figure it out.
At least exactly. At least two people can figure it out.
I mean, you're always going to have that problem, because, you know, what makes sense to me or what puzzles I can solve that may be completely foreign to anybody else or to a lot of other people. And the same with that. Something that's easy for you, I may have never come up with it. Don't limit yourself because of that. Don't fall into that trap of thinking, I'm just not good at it, I can't do it. Yes, you can. You can find ways to do it and incorporate it in there. Another thing that I would say along these lines, and we've sort of been talking around this, I think what's important for me with puzzles and games is a little goes a long way. I love a good puzzle. I don't love 10 good puzzles in a game session.
Oh, no.
Don't kill it. Don't wear it out. Have one in there, and that's great. That's good. You just don't need to go puzzle after puzzle, I don't think.
And I think if you do decide to put puzzles in your game, you should bring face protection.
Because you're going to get punched in the face.
Exactly.
I think the most important thing for me is if you're going to put a puzzle in your game, play fair with your players. Give them everything they need to solve it. But if they come up with an original idea,
absolutely,
if they come up with a way around this or something you just didn't think of that should logically work, don't cheat them out of that. If you really want a puzzle in your game, come back next time, try it again. I would be very frustrated if every time I came up on something, I came up with an original idea. Well, I have this spell I can turn to mist, so I missed the lock. Well, it's magically protected.
Yeah, and Wayne, this is something I really wanted to talk about, so I'm glad you brought it up. In this show, I at least have always railed against the Baron von Badass, the NPC that the Game Master is so attached to that he will simply disregard anything that might harm the guy. The situation where the Game Master doesn't want to tend a certain way, so no matter what the party does, no matter what they earn, they're just not allowed to keep it. And I think you can absolutely have the Baron von Bad Trap, which is the exact same thing, where there's a puzzle that you meant to be of a certain difficulty, and when the party solves it another way, you don't accept it. But here's the thing. One of the real challenges when you create a trap in a lot of games, and fantasy games may be the worst offenders because of the presence of magic, but they're not the only offenders, is the fact that people may solve these things not just in ways that you didn't expect, but maybe ways that you fully did expect but didn't intend. There's a puzzle that keeps the door from opening, but you have stone shape. Why not just remove the freaking door? Well, it's magically guarded. Okay, I cast a spell magic on it. It doesn't work. Okay, if the wizard's capable of making something that's immune to this many forms of magic and physical attack, why'd he put it on a door and not his freaking robes? And this does start to get, honestly, in my mind, pretty BS-y. And in my mind, sci-fi games could get just as BS-y. You have to figure out some kind of cryptographic puzzle to get a door to open. Some dude in the party has a cutting torch. Why is it he can't cut through the wall? And this is not what you as a game master meant for the situation. But in my mind, once again, if you keep saying, I'm just not going to let your other solutions work, I think it starts to feel as a player very frustrating and railroaded.
You know, I think you can play with those too, though. Let's say someone does pull out the torch. Well, you're playing a sci-fi game. It's not unreasonable to think that there's some sort of alarms on this door or this wall. You know, let's say you're trying to get into a box and instead of coming up with a solution for it, they try to explode the box. There's a good chance whatever's inside is getting damaged. There can be consequences for it that can lead to interesting gameplay.
I'm of two minds on that, and I understand what you're saying there, Dan. And I guess coming from the player's perspective, since that's mainly what I am, I look at it this way. I think if you're going to be a good player and you go into a situation where the GM is presenting you with a puzzle, riddle, whatever, to get past a certain objective, even if you hate puzzles, I feel that you should at least give it a shot before you go on to the brute force way of doing it. And I guess what I mean is this. Don't just say, oh, God, I hate puzzles. I don't care. I'm just going to take out my axe and I'm going to chop through the door because screw you and your puzzles. That's the way I feel about your puzzles. And I think that's an extreme. I guess what I'm getting at is give it a shot first. It could be the simplest puzzle in the world. And you're like, screw it. I'm not doing puzzles. I'm taking out my shotgun and blowing through it. I think if the party has run up against this puzzle, they've beat their head against it and they just can't figure it out, then they come up with some alternative way and a creative way to do it. I think that that's awesome. I think that's cool. But I don't think that you should just go in saying, because I think that's kind of what opinions I've gotten from some people.
But Pat,
I think Chad has been that way. It's like, I'm not going to do it. I'm just going to go in there and I don't care what it is. I'm just going to bash my way through it.
You said a key word too, creative. I love the idea of the players coming up with a creative way to get around the puzzle.
Yeah,
that is,
I do too.
It's a puzzle in and of itself. How they came about it.
Well, but
if
I don't
it's
think
just
you know,
a, I pull out a hammer. That's right. A whole other story.
I think that I know players. I've seen players that have the opinion of, I go into a room and I see a trap and I pull out my hammer of trap destruction and just go for it because I'm not even going to give it a try to think through this puzzle.
Well,
I'm like, that's
you,
that you fail as a player.
Let me ask you a question.
Fail.
Isn't that in some ways though kind of metagame GM coddling? That I have no real in-character reason to have any desire to solve this. I am purely going to do it for the sake of indulging the GM. Let me give you an example, drawing from a real-life allegory. I just got my hair cut. When I got out of the car, I beat another group of people in and got my hair cut immediately as opposed to having to wait. And the reason I did that was not because I was per se trying to run ahead of them. I actually didn't realize they were going into the same shop as I was until after we were all in there. But they got out of their car, walked down the parking lot, and walked around one of those little dividers that they have in parking lots, typically between where the cars park and the stores are, that have all the plants in them. I walked straight through it. Now, I wasn't being an ass. There's nothing that would keep me from walking over this. I wasn't trampling delicate flowers. It was fairly hardy plants that were growing there. You want to know why I walked over it? Because the shortest distance between two points is a straight line. And between my car and that door was a row of plants.
Yeah.
And in the same way, if I'm in a game and there's a box and there's a key in the box I need and I have a hammer and the lock is a puzzle, guess what the shortest distance between two points is? I'm not trying to be an ass to the GM. And I realize the GM could certainly build in game consequences. It would be certainly be meaningful to say this was a puzzle that only a few people were supposed to know the answer to, or a few people are worthy of figuring out. And therefore, if you just hit it with a hammer, let's put this even in a sci-fi metaphor, the whole thing is lined with plastic explosives that are set up to a sensitive trigger, or who knows what, it's going to blow up the contents of the box. So there may be consequences to doing that. But if I see this box and see a puzzle on it, I would really hate as a player to have to stop and say, well, the only reason I'm going to attempt to figure this out is for the sake of indulging the GM.
Well, but I don't think that you're just indulging the GM there, because you sort of contradicted yourself with what you just sort of said. Yes, there can be game consequences. You hit it with a hammer and the plastic explosive goes off and destroys the key inside. But earlier you kind of said that if they do that, that's just, you know, the Baron von Bad Trap, the GM's being an ass by saying, you can't do that because it's magically impervious. Do you see where I'm coming from?
I think there's a subtle difference in the two examples.
You know,
correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe what Dan was originally objecting to isn't the box is lined with plastic explosives and it may blow up if you hit it with a hammer. It's hit it with a hammer all you want, it ain't going to open.
Yes.
That's the difference.
Okay. No matter what you come up with,
Right. You're forcing them to solve the riddle instead. But
yeah,
the same kind of thing with the plastic explosive. I mean, if you don't know it's there, if you don't know it's there and you do it and you blow it up, it's like, oh, okay. But you know what I'm saying? And I'm not saying, and again, I'm not saying that I am objecting to creative ways around it. If you can figure out a way, like the whole mist thing, you got a character who goes in the mist, he gets inside and he can work the lock from the inside and do it without having to solve the puzzle. That's great. And again, if I was running it, and I had a party that had a wizard that wanted to blow his high level spells in the first trap room by dispelling everything, I'd be like, go for it. You're done. He gets to the next room. So I'm going to dispel. Oh, wait, I've already cast all my spells for the day. Now we're screwed. You know, it's that kind of a thing. There are ways around it. I don't have a problem. It's just what I'm getting at is I don't like the lazy player that just says, I don't want to do it because I'm bored.
Let me start by agreeing with what Johan said. He did correctly represent my position, that my problem is not with complexity or consequence, and that's the distinction I would draw. My problem is with obfuscation. You have decided this is the solution. No other solution is acceptable. It's not even per se because of the nature of the device. It's whatever they attempt to do, it's just not going to work unless they put three blocks in a certain order. Mm-hmm. That's what I'm objecting to. And that's where I would draw the difference.
Okay. I think we're basically on the same page. I'm just saying that I think that, like you said, there are some subtle differences there because I would say that you would probably call the same ass hattery if the guy says you hit it with a hammer, but there was plastic explosive inside and you're like, bull. That wasn't there. You just decided to put that there because you didn't want to solve my puzzle.
Well, in my case, I just be like, yeah, you want to see the notes?
Well,
I'll call over everything but that one line. You can read it.
There you go.
You know, at that point, you've now introduced a new puzzle. The key was in there. How are you going to get in the door? You blew up the key.
Yeah.
Puzzle number two.
Can you now reassemble the key?
Right.
Here's something else I think would be pretty cool, and this may not work in every puzzle, but this could help with many puzzles, is incorporate physical props. We've talked about several times that we'd love to see more props at the table, and the general response we've seen on our forums is I think a lot of gamers out there would like to see more props. If there is a puzzle that involves rearranging blocks a certain way, bring the blocks. If there is a puzzle that involves rearranging sticks in a certain way, bring some popsicle sticks. If it's a cryptographic puzzle, bring some printouts. You know, here's what the wall looks like. Here's the symbols you see. Which symbol comes next? and hand them a piece of paper.
Oh, I'm so good at those.
Yeah, but that's right. Give them something physical to look at and hold on to. You don't just have to rely on your own description. And on top of that, I think that's one of the reasons why we were able to have the fun we did at Gen Con, because we could fan out around the room and interact with things. Mm-hmm. That we weren't bottlenecked by a GM. And in the same way, if there's a physical thing on the table, you take away the bottleneck of the GM because people now have something to look at, to interact with, to play with. I think that is still not sufficient to excuse you from having any kind of plot or setting consistency to the puzzle, but I do think it at least adds a better element of buy-in to it.
Yeah, if you're running through the sewer and you run across the door and there's a chess puzzle on it, you're doing something wrong.
Crazy wizard.
I don't know. I've heard Chad loves those.
Yeah, that was something Chad wanted to be sure we included in this show, was the issue of timing. And his complaint was there was a Resident Evil game he was playing, or he was trying to escape from somewhere. He's running through the sewers. Guys are hot on his heels. And then there's a puzzle on a door.
It was a chess puzzle.
You know what, though? I think he's full of crap because we know he loves chess. I mean, we're playing a damn game with chess pieces. So I call foul. I think he actually loved that puzzle with the chess pieces.
You know, he's not here. We can say he said whatever.
Yeah.
The example that I gave was Final Fantasy. I've always loved how you can't do a lot of the end game content, the optional content, until right before the final boss fight. So the meteor is in the sky, visible, falling on the world, and you go off to Chocobo Race for the next 20 hours.
You know, I've had that problem with MMOs, too. And maybe it's just me. I really want to get into the story of it. But I'll talk to one contact, and it'll be like, okay, this horrible thing is about to happen. You have to act quickly. And then I'll go to the store, sell stuff. I'll enchant stuff. I'll talk to another contact. Oh, no, this guy's falling over here. It's like, okay, all of this is going on all at the same time.
All right, Van Cleef's not that dangerous. Other groups have already killed him probably millions of times by point. So, wait, I don't think that's a puzzle issue. I think that's an issue of more just MMOs as they're built right now do a terrible job of conveying story. Certainly do a terrible job of conveying urgency outside of a fight.
Yeah.
Another tip I would strongly recommend, especially to deal with the possibly too obscure puzzle, is build in hints. Just go ahead and presuppose they might get stuck. If you've test run the puzzle with some other people, you probably have some ideas of where they might get stuck. Jot down some notes of, okay, if they're slowed down, here's something the NPC might suggest. Here's another slip of paper they might find. Here's something else that might just kind of give them a nudge in the right direction. And similarly, if you are worried about this puzzle stopping your game dead, because even with the hints, they're just not getting it, you always have the choice to not make the puzzle vital. That if they fail to solve a puzzle, maybe a trap goes off and they take a little bit of damage. Maybe they fail to get the coolest piece of treasure. Maybe they fail to get a piece of information that would help them with the plot later on. But it's not as if the plot stops. It's not as if the game is over because of the fact that they could not open a door, nor is the game simply stopped dead until they open that door. And you could even enforce this, because it's certainly human nature to want to solve something in front of you, of saying, look, you've only got so much time. There's somebody trapped in a car underwater. It's filling up. You've got 5 minutes to get them out before they drown. You've only got these tools to work with. Get to work, MacGyver. You take an egg timer, set it to 5 minutes, let it go. When it dings, the person drowns, and you get on with the game.
You know, I think that's one of the reasons why I want to see puzzles and things like that in games a lot, because I want to see those MacGyver moments. There is nothing cooler in a game than when the players come up with something that's just so off the wall, you never imagine it. All these pieces are falling together in place, and I want to see them put that to use against puzzles. I want to give them that opportunity to do something like that, and to be honest, I would be so blown away happy if I presented a puzzle and the players came up with one of those creative solutions that was not what I intended, but it works, and they talk about it later.
Here's a question I want to close out on. Are riddles entirely metagame? And if not, how do you keep them from being so? Because one of the concerns that I've always had about puzzles, and Joshiva raises this in his email as well, is that when you set up a puzzle, more often than not, it's the players that you're testing, not the characters. Do you guys agree with that assessment?
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, I hate to say that, but I mean, I like to think that if I could solve the puzzle, but I know my character couldn't, that I would let the character fail. But to be honest, I think I would be too into the puzzle.
Well, let's also go certainly the reverse extreme. Let's say you're playing a guy who has some massive superhuman alien intelligence, and I put a number puzzle in front of you.
I'm making an intelligence check.
Yeah, exactly. And
in this, the question is, how do you make an interesting puzzle without doing that? I would feel ridiculously cheated if there's a puzzle and I just roll a die. It's like, okay, here's the solution.
Yeah, I agree. I want to try to figure it out myself. But again, that's exactly what you're saying, though. It's totally meta because it's me. I want to solve the puzzle. It's not my character because, you know, look at it the other way. If you've got a character, say you've got this barbarian that has a single digit wisdom and intelligence, yet the player of that character is the one who solves this really hard riddle. That doesn't make any sense.
Well, I mean, along the same,
you know, it's like, I mean, I know that you know, the whole thing of you can put 50 monkeys in a room and for a year and they'll eventually type up, you know, Shakespeare.
10,000 monkeys.
It's still a bunch of crap. You know, that guy, he's got a 3 intelligence and a 3 wisdom. He's not going to solve this freaking puzzle.
You know, I had the same concern when Dan, you were just mentioning, bring in the cryptograph and set it down there for him. I've mentioned before that, you know, sometimes once the minis come out, it's pulling me out of the game.
Yes.
I think if I have a sheet of paper in front of me and a pencil, I think it's, I would have the same concern. It's pulling me out of the character. It's not necessarily pulling me out of the game. Or it's not pulling me out of the fun, but it is pulling me out of character.
And this is why I've always found puzzles so tricky. This is one of the reasons is you are playing against the characters at this point, not against the players. I think there are some ways around it. You can do what you can to keep the puzzle in the context of the story, to keep it in the context of the environment, to keep it descriptive. You as a game master can keep narrating things. It's possible there may be something else occurring. If they're trying to save someone who's drowning, you can describe what they're seeing and the growing panic on the shoreline or the mother screaming, please save my baby or whatever. If they've got a timer going, you can keep reminding them of the fact the clock's ticking down and whatever else is happening. If this is an environmental puzzle, one that's not so gratuitous as rearranging the blocks until the colors are all together, then certainly that right there, I would hope, would keep them a little bit more in the game. But Wayne, I agree with you. It is very hard on some of these puzzles to not give the sense to the players. They've just been yanked out of the game world. And I don't know, apart from number one, engineering the puzzle right, and number two, just like we've talked about trying to keep RP alive during combat, I think you can keep RP alive during puzzles on the GM side, as I just described. And on the player side, man, you just got to stay in character. If you've assumed voice for that character, keep that voice while solving the puzzle. If you've got a low or high intelligence, if you've got certain skills, keep that stuff in play. Keep reminding yourself of that. And game masters, you've got to have some give and take on this, at least in my mind. If you've got someone who's a smart guy or average intelligence, but they're not as smart as their character, let them make some checks. Let them make some attribute checks. Give them some freebies. Joshiva suggested something that I have actually done in past games and I've also seen done in modules where you have a situation, but in the margins of your notes, you write, if somebody has at least this many ranks of a certain skill, or makes an attribute save by at least this many points, here's some freebies I'm going to give them. They can attempt 2 solutions, and if they're wrong, I'll just say, your character knows this is not the correct solution. Try something else and move them on. Or say, okay, I'm going to give you a couple little hints or tidbits here, so a few little gimmies, because of the fact that you had these skills. And so there's sort of a handicap you build into the game that brings a player up to the level of their character, but I think it is still incumbent upon the player to remain strongly in character, both in terms of personality and self-enforced limitations as they approach the puzzle.
So this is something that sounds like everyone here is struggling with. So I'm really looking forward to, for anyone listening to this, come onto the forums, let us know, have you done this and had it be successful? What did you do differently that had it work? And to be honest, I'd also like to hear, maybe more fun, what's the worst example of this you've ever done?
And as Pat mentioned earlier, if you're a game master looking to incorporate puzzles into your game and you're just not good at coming up with ideas, there are many resources available. Go onto Google, type in puzzles, type in brain teasers. Heck, even type in RPG puzzles, dungeon puzzles, whatever.
Goalie mask. You'll need one.
Goalie mask and body armor. Wayne,
and if you're in Johan's gaming group, don't do any of this.
Wayne, there was even a book they gave you at Gen Con, which I've not read cover to cover, but flipping through, it appears to have at least a few nuggets in there.
Yeah, it's basically, it covers an entire encounter, and you've got, it's, you know, page by page, it tells you here's what happens, and then the puzzles are things in the back that you rip out and actually hand to your players.
Yeah, in case someone wants to look this up, it's a book called Thieves Island by Cloud Kingdom Games. Well, haven't read it cover to cover. This is not a deep endorsement, but like I said, having flipped through it, appears to have a few nuggets useful in there.
Yeah, they apparently have a whole series of these, and this one they gave away for free when I bought something else at their table, so it was worth glancing through at least.
All right, so once again, don't forget the dates on Fear the Con 4, March 18th and 19th with the Wing Knight on the 17th. Look forward to seeing all you guys there. Also, should be interesting because March 17th is St. Patrick's Day.
Yep, wear your green, people.
Which is, or orange, which is heavily celebrated here in St. Louis. In fact, I'm surprised they even let us rent it. When I called the place, they actually had to go check if they were even allowed to rent out part of the restaurant that night.
Oh, yeah. I'm surprised.
Fortunately, we got one of their banquet halls again, so we'll be off in our own little side room. We should have a blast. I'm definitely looking forward to Fear the Con 4. Every previous year has gone wonderfully, and I'm expecting Fear the Con 4 to be just awesome again. So, in the meantime, thank you guys for tuning in, and we will catch you next time.
No puzzles, later. No puzzles.
Pow, right in the kisser.
This has been a production of Fear the Boot, copyright 2010. Listeners are free to use the show in a non-commercial endeavor as long as credit is provided to feartheboot.com. You can find previous episodes and other resources at feartheboot.com. Fear the Boot is also a member of the Pulp Gamer Media Network of shows. You can find other great shows in this network at pulpgamer.com.